I thought it would be wise not to mention specifically departments and who helped do what, but I started and I left out sound and the flower lady. So thanks to them as well for making trumpets such a wonderful experience. This week's reading in the chronological Bible covered the Sermon on the Mount. If you are keeping up with that, that's where we are in there. Today we're going to look at the beginning of the sermon, where Christ states what is referred to as the Beatitudes. Beatitudes means blessed, and it's kind of one of those words that works out really neat in our language, where we can kind of split it up and say that means beautiful attitudes. Not that that's actually what the word means, but we can say it is because it's what it sounds like. But we're going to look at these Beatitudes here, and we're going to begin in Matthew chapter 5, starting in verse 1. This is the longest sermon that Christ gave on earth, the Sermon on the Mount. Matthew 5, verse 1. And seeing the multitudes, he went up on a mountain, and when he was seated, his disciples came to him. Then he opened his mouth and taught them, saying, "Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven." Blessed are the poor in spirit. What does it mean to be poor in spirit? It does not mean to be lacking in spirit. The kingdom of heaven is not reserved for those who lack the spirit. So there must be something else that's meant by this phrase, poor in spirit. It actually means that we realize we are absolutely nothing on our own. God's word translation reads as, "Blessed are those who realize they are spiritually helpless." We need to come to that realization. To be poor in spirit is to acknowledge honestly and with understanding our spiritual poverty. To know that we are spiritually bankrupt before God. We are sinners and on the strength of our lives deserve nothing but God's judgment. We're not doing anything of our own that God needs. We have nothing to offer, nothing to bargain with, nothing to which to buy favor from the Lord. Nobody will be able to stand before God and say, "Let me into your kingdom because I bring whatever." We have nothing to negotiate with. God doesn't need us to bring anything in that's lacking in his kingdom. Being poor in spirit is realizing that all we can do is repent, and through the grace of God, he allows the blood of Christ to cover our sins, which gives us that access to the presence of God. In Psalm 34 and verse 18, we read, "The Lord is near to those who have a broken heart and saves such as has a contrite spirit." God looks on the one who is brokenhearted, who has a repentant spirit, who realizes we do many things that breaks God's heart. But we still have that desire to obey God. As a help in understanding this attitude, I suggest you read the parable of the Pharisee and the tax collector found in Luke 18. The Pharisee thought so high of himself. He thought he had so much to offer. The tax collector had the proper attitude, who could not even lift his eyes up, but just say, "Have mercy on me, a sinner." Realized who he was, what he had to offer. He was poor in spirit. The reward for being poor in spirit is the kingdom of heaven. In the future, we know that this means a literal kingdom under the rule of Jesus Christ with God's laws. Something we're all looking forward to. And we can have a much better understanding of what a blessing that is if we are poor in spirit and realize it's going to be a gift from God that gets us there. Next, Matthew 5, verse 4, Jesus said, "Blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted." What do we have to mourn? We all have things from time to time in our lives that we mourn over, that make us sad. Mourning in the Bible means to express a deep anguish when God appears to be angry, distant, or silent. Those who mourn feel a sense of humility and sadness, whether the concern is for us, for others, for our nation, or for the world. We should mourn the plight of mankind. It should not be hard to look at what is going on in the world and just feel sorry for mankind, to really mourn over their choices that they're making. Mr. Pedworth talked about the war going on right now. You know, it's easy to look at something like that and take sides and say, well, this country's right or this country's wrong. I even thought it was kind of interesting that he used the word offensive, that Israel's gone on the offensive. You know, many people look at that and say, no, this is still defensive. They were attacked. But there's a lot of people caught up in these wars who wish to have no part in it, no matter what side they're on. We should mourn for the plight of mankind. We are created in the image of God. That's an incredible thought to think about. Created in the image of God. We started out in the Garden of Eden, had direct contact with God. Look how far we've strayed from the original intent that God had. Even Israel rejected him as their king. What a sad day that was for them. Every day, God's creation seems to stray further and further away from him. It is a very sad state. It is something to mourn. We should mourn and even weep at the state of the world. Not just hear it and let it go, because you do hear so much about wars in the Middle East and skirmishes. Still a very sad event. In Ezekiel 9, we see that people who sighed and cried over the lawlessness state of their city somehow found a place of safety from the terror. God had compassion on those who looked at what was going on around them and sighed and cried. Didn't just become a part of society, didn't just accept it. We need not to do that. The blessing for those who mourn is the blessing of comfort. Comfort is so much needed in this world. Jesus came to comfort those who mourn. I won't turn there, but you can put in your notes Luke 4, verses 17 through 21. Jesus talked about coming to comfort those who needed to be comforted. The blessing for those who see things in this world to mourn over is that we will find comfort. God can give us comfort through his word, through the understanding that we have, knowing that mankind makes some pretty stupid decisions and is on a path to destruction. And if God didn't stop them, the gates on that path are wide open. Definitely something to mourn over. Matthew 5, verse 5, Jesus Christ goes on and says, "Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth." This is something that we know will be in the future. There's a song out that says something to the effect of God's going to give the world to the meek, and the singer says, "What good is a used up world and who would want it?" or something like that. But we know it's going to be a new world. It's going to be a good world. It's going to be something worth inheriting. Being meek means that we are pleasant and unassuming. But it also involves a steel-like strength when needed. But it's always under control. Always under control. Numbers 12 and verse 3 tells us that Moses was the most meek person on the face of the earth. But Moses was not weak. Moses had a big job to do. Moses was leading millions of people. That was not a job for a weak person. A weak person could not have done what Moses did. Moses was a strong leader. Christ was meek and gentle. Christ, of course, had a love that most people could not understand. Even those who were around him were like, "Why is he hanging out with those people? Doesn't he know who they are?" Which you have to wonder sometimes, what did that person who made that comment think of themselves? You know, "He should be hanging out with me. I'm so good." Christ was submissive, gentle, patient, and kind. But think of when he overturned the money changers' tables and threw the merchandisers out of the temple. They didn't belong there. That was his father's house, and he wanted them out. They were making a mockery of God's temple. He was strong when he needed to be strong, but he always had that strength under control. Those who develop this fruit of the Spirit are the ones that God will give the earth. What an incredible inheritance to look forward to. Going on, Matthew 5, verse 6, Jesus says, "Blessed are they which do hunger and thirst after righteousness, for they shall be filled." Hunger and thirst are great motivators. Barclay describes this as, "It's the hunger of the man who is starving for food and the thirst of a man who will die unless he drinks." Now, we've probably never been to that extent, although next Saturday we might convince ourselves that we are. But it is a strong, strong desire, one that can never really be satisfied. It's never being able to have enough righteousness, but always, always seeking more. Always looking, examining ourselves, thinking, "What more can I do to be like God?" Hungering and thirsting is a cycle that never ends. We know that as physical beings. We have a joke at our house that we're always planning our next meal because we find ourselves a lot of times we'll be sitting down eating and the topic will turn to, "What are we going to have for dinner tomorrow night?" Because we know no matter how satisfied we get, tomorrow night we're going to want more. It is something that even when satisfied, the desires come back quickly. So what is this righteousness that we're to hunger and thirst after? What is it that this driving force should be pushing us to at all times? Psalm 119, verse 172. Psalm 119, verse 172. My tongue shall speak of thy word, for all thy commandments are righteousness. It's pretty simple. It's laid out. Right there is the answer. That's what we're to be hungering and thirsting for. All of God's commandments. And I know you know this, but it never hurts to repeat it. God's commandments are for our good. They are not a punishment. They're for our good. God didn't give us these commandments because He doesn't want us to have fun. He gives us His commandments because He wants us to have a long, fulfilled life that leads to an even longer, more fulfilled life. The righteousness that we are to hunger and thirst for is to do right, to be virtuous, to be upright, to be just and fair, uncompromising, and morally correct. We can't compromise when it comes to God's word. If we are, we're only fooling ourselves into thinking it's okay. You and God don't have some special understanding where He's letting you do things that you know you should not be doing. The blessing is that we will be filled both now with understanding and in the future we will be filled by the one who is able to fill us eternally. Revelation 7, verse 16. Revelation 7, verse 16. They shall hunger no more, neither thirst no more. Neither shall the sun light on them, nor any heat. For the Lamb, which is in the midst of the throne, shall feed them, and shall lead them unto living fountains of waters. And God shall wipe away the tears from their eyes. That is such a beautiful sentiment. We're going to be taken care of. We're going to be fed. We're going to be watered, both spiritually, physically, whatever we need or want. And then to have it wrapped up by saying, God shall wipe away all tears from their eyes. When I read that, I picture God Himself reaching out, as a father does their child sometimes when they're crying, and wiping away the tears under their eyes. Matthew 5, verse 7, Jesus Christ goes on and says, blessed are the merciful, for they shall obtain mercy. Mercy. How many people receive mercy? The Interpreter's Bible states that the Romans despised pity. As a Roman soldier, it was almost illegal to have mercy on someone. The Greeks also held similar views, thinking that mercy indicated weakness rather than strength. Satan has just turned everything upside down and got people looking at all these things completely opposite of what they are. Aristotle wrote that pity was a troublesome emotion. This view had certainly crept into the thinking of the religious leaders of Christ's day. They didn't have pity or mercy. The Pharisees, who were harsh in their self-righteous judgments of others, showed very little mercy. You can read about that as you go through the New Testament and see why Christ kept calling them out as hypocrites. In Matthew 23 and verse 23, He called them out for their lack of mercy. He says, woe to you, scribes and you Pharisees, hypocrites! For you pay tithe of mint and anise and cumin and have neglected the weightier matters of the law, which are justice and mercy and faith. These you ought to have done without leaving the others undone. So they were right in one aspect, but sadly lacking in another. Christ says, you got to do it all. You can't pick and choose. You have to have justice and mercy and faith. Being merciful does not only mean you sympathize with a person. It does not mean simply to feel sorry for someone in trouble, which that is a part of it. We feel sorry for people. We sympathize with them. But it's having the ability to get right inside the other person's skin until we can see things with his eyes, think things with his mind, and feel things with his feelings. This takes a real concerning effort to put yourself in the place of someone else. We have the old saying, you know, walk a mile in someone's shoes before you judge them. I don't know what the whole saying is. We shouldn't judge anybody. But walk a mile in someone's shoes. Put yourself in their place. We can be quick to make judgments. We should not be. John 1 verse 14 tells us that the Word became flesh. The Word became flesh. Jesus Christ literally put himself in our skin to see how we see things and to feel how we feel things. Hebrews 4 verse 15 tells us we do not have a high priest who cannot sympathize with our weaknesses, but was in all points tempted as we are, yet without sin. The reward for being merciful is something that everybody wants, even those who refuse to show mercy. The reward is to receive mercy. And we all need that. Going on, Matthew 5, verse 8, Jesus Christ said, "Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God." Are you paying attention to these rewards? They shall see God. For something to be pure, it must conform absolutely to a standard of quality. There are no shortcuts to making pure gold, pure silver. And there are no shortcuts to making a pure Christian. Purity is achieved and maintained by effort and attention. In the Old Testament, purity could sometimes be achieved through rituals, but this ceremonial purity gradually became seen as symbolic rather than genuine purity. There were rituals that they would do to purify things. Genuine purity does not come from ceremonial action. It involves moral conduct. David understood this, and that's what he was writing about in the book of Psalms. Psalms 51, starting in verse 16. Psalm 51, verse 16. David says, "For you do not desire sacrifice, or else would I give it to you. You don't delight in burnt offering. The sacrifices of God are a broken spirit, a broken and contrite heart. These, O God, you will not despise." If we want to be pure before God, it involves taking action of the heart and the mind. We need to keep ourselves pure by avoiding that which is not pure. Holiness cannot be transferred from one to another. On the other side, though, defilement can easily be transferred. You can't throw hamburger meat in a bowl of ham salad and make the ham salad clean. It just doesn't work. But if you throw a pork shoulder in a beef stew, the whole thing becomes defiled and is unclean. We need to make sure we are removing ourselves from that which is not pure. This is one of the things that we should be examining our lives for at all times. We should be in a constant state of self-examination, not just in the spring holy days. This is one of the reasons we don't observe Christmas or Easter, which have some truth, but is defiled with false religions and teachings of Satan. We can't honor God through those days. It's not possible. The reward is to see God. When we become like God, we see and understand better who He is and what He is doing and what He has in store for us. And everyone in this room and rooms like it around the world, God has a plan for. Going on, Matthew 5, verse 9, Jesus said, "Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called the children of God." Peacemakers. We're to be a peacemaker between ourselves and others. Peacemaker is not a word you hear very often. Sometimes we have peacemakers who will go to troubled areas and bring the sides together and try to intervene and get them to work together to reach some sort of peace. We need to be the kind of peacemaker that doesn't need that third party. We need to be the peacemaker ourselves, between us and others. Matthew 5, verse 23, we read, "Therefore, if you bring your gift to the altar, and there remember your brother has something against you, leave your gift there before the altar and go your way. First, be reconciled to your brother, then come and offer your gift." Reconciliation to our brother is very important. You see, we're not in the right frame of mind if we're offended, or we have offended someone, or we've become offended. We're not in the right frame. God says, you're not even in the right frame of mind to come and give a gift before the altar. You got to take care of that first. Then come and do what you were going to do. Romans 12, verse 18 says, "If it is possible," which means it may not always be possible, "but if it is possible, as much as depends on you, live peaceably with all men." That means we have to put forth the effort. We can't just write off someone and say, "Ah, they're just impossible to get along with." Now, there is a point where we may reach where we just have to separate ourselves from someone. And that's the clue, is you separate yourself from that person. You don't stay in a contentious relationship, because then you're not being that peacemaker. But if it is possible, as much as depends on you, live peaceably with all men. We have to put effort into it. We're to follow the example set by Jesus. In 1 Peter 2, verse 23, we are told that Christ did not revile in return when he was reviled, and when he suffered, he did not threaten. Jesus could have threatened. Jesus could have threatened big. But he didn't. He was a peacemaker. Our reward for being a peacemaker is to be called the children of God. People will be able to recognize we are God's children. They might not say it in those exact words, but they will think, there is something special about that person. I could not have reacted the way that person reacted. We become as intended from the beginning. Again, we are made in the likeness and image of God. We need to act like God acts. We need to let that family resemblance carry on to our actions and our attitudes. Matthew 5, verse 10, Jesus says, blessed are they which are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Persecution. Persecution will come on us all. It will come in different forms, from different people, at different times, for different reasons. But persecution will come on the children of God. I know this because persecution comes on everybody. Everybody's persecuted for one reason or another. We're talking about being persecuted for righteousness' sake. This persecution is the mark of a true Christian. Matthew 13, verse 20. Matthew 13 and verse 20, but he who received the seed on stony places, this is he who hears the word and immediately receives it with joy. So excited. Oh, man, this is something I've never heard before. I love it. I can't wait. Oh, how many of us can think of people who came here and was all excited and I'm going to be here forever and there's plenty of empty seats? Verse 21 says, yet he has no root in himself, but endures only for a little while. For when tribulation or persecution arises because of the word, immediately he stumbles. Now, I know some of you in this room have gone through some very rough times being persecuted for righteousness' sake, many from within your own home. And you've endured. The one who cannot endure persecution returns to the world. It's just easier. Being a Christian is not always about being easier. We're not always going to have an easy path to follow. Only those who are truly committed to God will endure the persecution. Why would someone endure persecution if they're not truly committed to God's way of life? What would be the benefit? But I know many of you have dealt with persecution and are still here. Matthew 24, verse 13, Jesus says that the one who endures to the end shall be saved. I'd like to read the next couple of verses here, of Matthew 5, verses 11 and 12, from the New Living Translation, which is the translation of the chronological Bible that we've been reading through. Matthew 5, verse 11, these are the words of Jesus Christ. God blesses you when people mock you and persecute you and lie about you and say all sorts of evil things against you because you are my followers. God blesses you. And then he says, be happy about it. Be glad. For a great reward awaits you in heaven. And remember, the ancient prophets were persecuted in the same way. It's nothing new. Jesus Christ himself was persecuted for it. Of course, we're going to be. The reward for enduring persecution is the kingdom of heaven. The kingdom of heaven is something that we are all focusing on, especially now during these fall holy days, as we hear messages about Christ's return, putting away of Satan, setting up God's government, and then ultimately having everyone who's ever lived have that opportunity, even those who couldn't withstand the persecution, to come back and live a life without the persecution. Although there'll probably be some self-persecution, regret. The reward for enduring this persecution is the kingdom of heaven. And I hope that we're all focusing on that kingdom. And it is real to us. I know many of you have been hearing about it for 50 or 60 years. Don't ever give up on these teachings. These are sure. They are going to happen. Jesus Christ is going to return. And all things will be made right. So from the Beatitudes, we learn that the blessed of God recognize their need for God. They are compassionate. They're humble. They're hungry for righteousness. They're merciful. They are pure in heart. They are peacemakers, and if need be, they are willing to be persecuted for righteousness' sake. If we, as God's children, develop and maintain these beautiful attitudes, we will truly be blessed.